Good morning, and I want to thank Pierre Michel for inviting me here to the Collège de France, which has practiced openness towards the public for a very long time. I want to take you through various facets of openness, but basically my intervention is a plea for the, what I call the radical openness of science. What is the appeal of openness? We hear about openness now all the time. Openness is in, there are terms like open science, open access, crowdsourcing, openness to the world, etc., science 2.0, etc., etc. And this sometimes hypertrophic rhetoric of openness of science and innovation contrasts, however, with the paucity of empirical research we have on this phenomenon. We know very little in terms of comparison also which are the scientific fields that are more open than others and are taken in by these tendencies. And we know very little what impact it actually makes. What are the dominant forms? Will it have an impact on the theme of our conference here, the transformations of how science works? We do not know as yet. And therefore, one tendency which goes back to the theme of the conference, what are the transformations, is already here. We see a transition or a push towards a transition from open science towards an innovation. Open science started from within. Open access was a soft revolt by researchers themselves against the high prices that publishers are asking for the journals and to publish their articles. Slowly, but surely policymakers and funding agencies have begun to respond to open access. Much more difficult is already the openness of data. Sharing data is a very complicated process. And although at the surface of it, one can argue, and there are good reasons for arguing, that sharing knowledge benefits everyone, if you look into actual practice, there are many problems that still need to be solved. But we begin to see this transition, the push from open science towards innovation. And the commissioner, the EU commissioner for research, technology and innovation, he came up with the slogan of the three O's: open science, open innovation, open to the world. But as you see, he put open innovation first, and this came with his observation that the universities and research institutions are not, they are producing many scientific findings and ideas, but the process of putting them to the market is much too slow, in his opinion. And he added to this the openness towards the world. What else can you say? So let's have a look and ask the question, why now? Obviously, one of the driving forces behind these tendencies towards openness has to do with digitalization and with computerization. But you could also say science has always been open. It has been international from its very beginning, and yet at the same time, it has carefully managed its boundaries. It has guarded itself and what happens within science against and defending it against political interference, and it has also very carefully tried to manage its relationship with industry. Nevertheless, the push towards openness is the push towards what is widely perceived to be the next frontier. Combining open science with open innovation promises to widen both scale and scope from local to global, from regions cities to crucial hubs in a global world, and it's sweeping across many sectors. It has the force to combine market and non-market mechanisms and to blur all kinds of boundaries. But openness is more than just territorial expansion. It has to do with people, of bringing in new stakeholders, new actors, to involve citizens. And we should remind ourselves that we have never lived before in a world where the level of overall education has been as high as it is today. And opening towards citizens and bringing them into these processes is another promise that comes with it. Timing, if you ask the question of why now, timing is obviously important. And this has to do with the increasing pressure towards global competitiveness. Wherever you go and you listen to policymakers speaking in front of the public, you will be prepared to hear global competitiveness is the driving force behind. And it's another way of speaking about the urgency of running faster in order not to fall behind. So the appeal of openness results from the convergence of different levels. We have the political level. Commissioner Mördös is one example for this, captured by the three oaths he's promoting. On the economic level, innovation has always practiced openness for its own benefit, especially in the ICT field. Users have been involved from the beginning when the web started to involve users with their solutions that were then picked up by companies. And on the scientific level, there's also the pressure towards greater accessibility and accountability. So these are some of the reasons behind the driving force, the instrumentation that is now available for us, and it's the convergence at these different levels. But none of these propulsions forwards are straightforward. A closer look reveals many constraints of openness. We like to speak about crossing boundaries, daring to cross institutional boundaries, disciplinary boundaries. There is a very strong push towards increasing the amount of interdisciplinary work that is being done, or transdisciplinary, depending on how you define it. And these are forces that make you sometimes believe that no boundaries exist anymore, that they all become open and porous. But institutions, by definition, have boundaries. And in science and technology studies, we have captured this phenomenon, and we call it boundary work. So there are mechanisms in place to keep the institutional boundaries open and closed at the same time, selectively open them and selectively closing them. The same happens with interdisciplinarity. There's an enormous literature on interdisciplinarity, on why it is important, why there should be more. But looking at this literature, it is also quite surprising to see how much of this literature is devoted to the obstacles that prevent what should be done. It's an analysis of what stands against practicing interdisciplinarity. And so we have to realize, and that's the conclusion to be drawn, that indeed it is much more difficult to open disciplinary boundaries in practice. And while some of it happens, and certainly creative new insights in science happen very often at the interface of disciplines, and scientists know this very well, but nevertheless, there is also a persistence of disciplinary boundaries related to the way how our universities are structured, vested interests, and much, much more. But nevertheless, and this makes me think that openness coexists with closure. Boundaries are open and closed more or less at the same time in a selective way. And Also moving towards open innovation, many promising startups are bought up, if they are promising indeed, by large companies. They disappear inside the large companies. So you can be open, but then you are incorporated into a much larger entities. And by now, many universities in the ICT fields, particularly, are competing with large companies, corporations like Google, for the most talented researchers there are. Then there are governance issues that have to do with openness, yes, but at the end, who pays the bill for open access? We have the discussion about gold open access, green open access, etc., and who foots the bill. Data sharing, as I mentioned already, sounds wonderful in principle, but in practice, again, it encounters many hurdles. And finally, and this is, if you want, a sociological statement, every inclusion means that others are excluded. And therefore, I think it is worthwhile to think about openness also as having constraints and limitations. Let me just give you one little example here. This is Twitter thread. I'm a research parasite. And this is the witty response of a group of researchers who were accused by others: if you do data sharing, you have to list everyone with whom you share your data as your co-authors. Now, the list becomes endless. What do you do? So this is their witty way of saying, I'm a research parasite, and it alerts us to some of the problems that exist. And again, I come back to this. There, we have to differentiate between scientific fields. For some fields, it is much more possible, and it comes much more easy than for others. For instance, in the geosciences, ocean floor, chemistry, etc., there are huge corporations that have existed since a very long time. They know how to practice data sharing. You can do nothing as an individual researcher unless you are part of this enormously and well-organized community. In other areas, you have small research groups, and that's the way how science progresses. So it's not a homogeneous spread of openness across fields. And again, the organization of Le Travail Scientifique depends very much on what is there, what is the nature of scientific work, the necessity of using sharing of instruments, sharing of data. Many of these differences are just sort of glossed over when we just hear the word open science, open innovation. Now, I want to turn to open science, open innovation, open citizen, and then move on from there. Open science, I want to give you two brief examples. One comes from my experience as president of the European Research Council. Now, the European Research Council was a radical policy move on the part of the European Commission. Frontier research, fundamental research, had no place, an official place, in the funding of the European Commission before 2007. It crept in through the back door. In the life sciences, it's not possible to sharply separate what is fundamental research, what you do in the morning, what is applied research is what you do in the afternoon. But officially, it had never been acknowledged and it had no funding scheme. And in 2007, the Commission decided, and I wish I could tell you that it was the lobbying of the scientific community that led to it, but the story is not that simple, and there were other reasons for setting it up. But it was established in 2007, and the radical policy consisted in entrusting the setting up and the operation of it to 22 scientists, the ERC Scientific Council. And indeed, we set the strategy, and we said we want to have only one criteria, and that's excellence only. So no quota system, no jus retour, nothing of the kind of funding that was known and is practiced in other parts of the Commission framework programs. It should be bottom-up only, and therefore only the best should win. The success rate of the ERC, and this has remained more or less constant, is 10%. So 90% of those who apply fail, and 10% get an ERC grant. The grant is generous, it's for 5 years, and it gives the freedom to the scientists to really to pursue their ideas. So no thematic priorities. So if there's openness of science, that's there. And yet, and I use this as an example to point out to some of the constraints that even if you have the best of intention, you convince policymakers, they do what is absolutely necessary to give a space, to provide a space for openness of science. Nevertheless, we came up with the proof of concept scheme as a way of responding to the pressure we felt, what are you doing for innovation? Now, fundamental research cannot be applied the next day to innovation. It takes 10, 15, sometimes 50 years until something comes out of it that can be applied. Nevertheless, we kept feeling the heat, what are you doing for innovation? So we set up the proof of concept scheme, a little scheme that allows ERC grantees to get some extra funding to allow them to pursue their ideas that may lead to something that crops up on the market later on. And although we clearly said, and it is true, talented people are everywhere in Europe and outside Europe, in the most unlikely places, nevertheless, we see the Matthew Principle at work. The Matthew Principle, for those who have not heard this term before, goes back to Robert K. Merton, who, by the way, was one of my teachers at Columbia University. And he's Matthew from the Bible, it will be given to those who already have. So it is institutions, it's research groups that benefit disproportionately if they are already well established and successful. This is the demand side, if you want. And you see here a country like Italy, where the demand push is enormous. So they come in here as second, which does not mean that they will be as successful. If we look, and this is the Matthew Principle in full operation, these are the latest data, the ERC grants go to 670 different host institutions in 33 countries. It's not just the EU. You can also be an ERC grantee if you work outside, but you have to work half of the year in an EU host institution. But 90% concentration, 90% go to 10 countries. And 50% of ERC grants end up in 50 top institutions. And these figures have practically not changed. The numbers have gone up naturally, but they have not changed. And in terms of countries, you see the UK way on top. Germany and France come behind. In Germany, for a long time, we were thinking that it's other funding is available. For France, I don't know why it is taking the third place. And then come other countries like Netherlands, Italy, etc., and from the associated country, Switzerland and Israel stand out as very potent scientific countries. I want to give you another example to illustrate the openness of science. And this is the case of CRISPR. Now, in case you have not heard of CRISPR before, CRISPR is an adaptive immune system which is used by microbes to defend against viruses by recognizing, recording, and targeting them and cutting their DNA sequence. So this is something, a natural phenomenon that happens the way how microbes defend themselves against viruses. And this has been transformed and repurposed into a simple technique which is now used by labs all around the world. And if you look at citation about CRISPR, you will see how enormously it has gone up. So what I'm referring here to and what I find interesting, this is a paper that has been published by Eric Lander in January this year. He calls them the heroes of CRISPR, and he wanted to recount how did this come about. Nothing falls from the sky, so how did this come about? And what he shows is a history that goes back to the year 1993, to Alicante. Sorry, you cannot see this very well, but it starts out in Spain, in Alicante. A researcher who was, Alicante is near the marshes, he was interested, what do microbes do to defend themselves against the salt in their environment? So what are the coping mechanisms? And he stumbled across a mechanism that was the recognition of CRISPR as the first instance. Then the story moves on here to Paris. Gilles Vergnon, who first worked at the Pasteur Institute, then moved to the Ministry of Defense. This was the time of the invasion of Iraq. The Ministry of Defense asked their researchers to work on something else than they had been working on. And then he discovered the mechanism how these microbes remember that they had been aggressed by a virus. So this was yet another stepping stone. And so you add stepping stone after stepping stone until we come to the contemporary heroes, and they look like this. And I will say more about them in a minute. But what are the lessons from this long story we can draw for the openness of science? Well, first of all, nobody set out to achieve what was achieved. And this is one of the main lessons of openness of science and of radical openness of science. You do not know what you will find. Nobody was motivated by, you know, we need a tool, and now CRISPR is becoming a tool for gene editing. We will be able to cut out certain parts of the gene if it has negative consequences. Nobody set out to do that. And the origins, therefore, are unpredictable. You have people here and there. You have small and unlikely epistemic spaces in which researchers are addressing research questions they find fascinating. They find they're driven by their curiosity and passion, and they go on doing it. They also encounter obstacles. These very often, at the time when it happened, were young people, often under 30, and they had difficulties. Francisco Mujica and also Gilles Vergnon, they had difficulties in getting their paper accepted. It took them 1.5 years. The paper was rejected by Nature on grounds, you know, this is nothing new, which was ridiculous because it was groundbreaking. So they have to fight with these difficulties they encounter. They need persistence. Also, none of these research paths was driven by a hypothesis. So in a way, if we speak about le travail scientifique et ses transformations, it has very much to do with the fact that we now have these open-ended, large-scale genomic databases. And this has become, you know, the pool of ideas to work with, the material with which to work. And also, if you look at, let me go back here, up north, you know, you see an unlikely place like Vilnius. Who would ever think, you know, this is where important scientific discoveries happen? And yet they do. And without this proceeding, you know, one is building on the other. Sometimes they don't know about each other initially. Then they go to a conference, they find out someone has been doing interesting work there. And this is how it accumulates, but it takes time. 1993 to 1912. This is a brief history of CRISPR, which will really, and I use this term very, very seldom, revolutionize the way how we do genomic research. Now, what is interesting about the paper, the heroes is of course a term that only scientists use these days. From social science point of view, we would not call them heroes, but Eric Lander uses the term heroes. What he does not mention in this paper at all, and I found it striking, is that these three people you see here, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, are locked in a, or their lawyers are locked in a fierce patent dispute. And the story behind it is that Doudna and Charpentier, they submitted an application to the US Patent and Trade Office in May 2012. And Feng Zhang from the Broad Institute submitted in December another application that CRISPR can be applied to mammalian cells, not just other organisms, but mammalian cells. And he asked, and this is one of the legal peculiarities of the American intellectual property right system, he asked for a fast track. So his patent was granted fast track, and then, of course, Doudna and Charpentier said, wait a moment, you know, we were first, how can you put him on a fast track? And they called for what is called a patent interference. So I was struck, you have this beautiful paper reconstructing the history of CRISPR, and Feng Zhang works in the same institute like Eric Lander, and he does not even mention the patent dispute with one word. He was later accused by Doudna and Charpentier that he's downplaying their contribution in order to help Feng Zhang, but so much for open science and open innovation in practice. Let me now turn towards open innovation rather briefly. There is a lot of ambivalence surrounding the term. What does it actually mean? The term goes back to Jespro in 2003, coming from a business school. But again, we have very little empirical evidence, and most of it is anecdotal. There are questions of intensity and direction of innovation, and we presume positive effects, but we know nothing about possible negative effects that open innovation might have. I have been able only to find two studies, two foresight projects that try to see, you know, what is changing in open innovation. And they come up with the following findings. They say, market mechanisms as the main coordinating mediator of supply and demand is being challenged by non-market mechanisms. So there is this coexistence of market mechanism and non-market mechanism that they see as a trend emerging. You have patient groups, something that has been around for some time, obviously a non-market mechanism. Nevertheless, you know, the drug companies very much rely on and tap into the knowledge that patient groups have, et cetera, et cetera. There are many examples of this kind, but all of them piecemeal, anecdotal, and not done in a systematic way. Then there may be repercussions on the motivation. Firms are driven by the motivation of profit. And here are other intrinsic motivations that come up. You want to help to solve, to come up with possible therapeutics for a disease, et cetera, et cetera. And there are also new societal demands that are being brought into the innovation landscape because you have other shareholders and other actors. And also they find a spatial shift, and cities in particular become innovation hubs. But they also have a kind of warning that if you overdo it, we may end up with a kind of innovation, open innovation participation fatigue. Openness for citizen, as you see, the phenomenon is an old one. The 19th century in particular, this journal goes back to a year, 1827, I think it was, 1878, the other one to 1892, Science Gossip. Isn't it a nice term, Science Gossip? It's now the name of a website. And this also shows us the transformation. Now we do digitally what some of these so-called amateurs in the 19th century did by joining clubs, by going to cafes and discussing what are the latest findings, and also by exchanging letters with scientists. Darwin is famous for having had correspondence all over the world, and he was drawing on their letters and the material they supplied to him for his own work, but he was also responding to his to the people with whom he was exchanging letters. So again, we don't know exactly what this kind of openness towards citizen or citizen science, as it is now called, what it is, who does what. If you look at an n-gram, you see the terms are changing. It first was called, the blue line is popular science, then there was amateur science, and then since the 1980s, you have the sharp rise up citizen science. Now, a possible typology of trying to find out, you know, who are the people doing this now, in particular the last yellow point upwards. There are people, and this is a very rough typology, there are people who use their computer skills and their affinity with the digital world to do volunteer computing. This started with the helping to find galaxies, the galaxy zoo. It went on to protein folding. These are famous examples of involving citizen science. There are the makers. By now in many cities in Europe and the US, you have makers fair. So these are inventors, as they were called in the 19th century. They come up, they do things. And again, there is a connection in the US. If you go to Stanford and there's a makers fair, you see faculty of Stanford University going out and talking with the makers and interacting with them. Then there are those who observe and monitor, especially in the environmental field, citizens that have been involved in monitoring soil quality, pollution control, etc. Again, it's a long, long history of their involvement and their analysis. So this is a possible typology that tells us a little bit of what is happening. But we also see, because what is new is that we speak from mere participation of labor towards empowerment. It's not just that they are volunteers working for free to help science to move on, but also people who have their own questions and they want to be heard, they want to be empowered, they want to become recognized also in their with the expertise they bring to it. And again, here we have a number of questions. Does citizen science transform science-society relations? And if so, how? Does it have an impact on the production of knowledge? Again, if so, how? Who are the participants exactly apart from these typologies? Do they drop out after having done it once? Do they continue? We know very little about their demography. And where we know very little is their motivation or their moral economy, if you want to call it that way, that sustains citizen science. Now, let me turn towards the impact on the organization of scientific work. which is the main theme of this day. Now, science has always seen major organizational shifts that go with what the science demands. Organization follows, accompanies, sometimes even precedes the direction that science is taking. This obviously varies from field to field. Experimental sciences are different. We could see a major shift once simulation models could gain ground by having the computerization of science everywhere, wet science, dry science, etc. So these are some of the major shifts. The 19th century, it was really from the second half of the 19th century onward, the institutionalization of universities and of research inside the university, and then moving the lab from the university into industry, where initially at least they had the same kind of autonomy as in the universities, but with a temporal limit. If it was shown that after 5 years or so, not much would come out of interest to the company, it was closed down. But in terms of doing science, it was similar. 20th century, undoubtedly, big science, the military industrial complex. Derek de Solla Prize, little science, big science, you know, a landmark, what was behind this shift towards big science. And in the 21st century, we can clearly see the trend continues. We have globalization of science. We have large-scale types of organizations. We have much more collaboration that is needed. And we have a digital way of of doing it. Nevertheless, and this is part of the radical openness of science, individuals still have their place. And they need what I call epistemic spaces. They need a place that is epistemic, that allows them to pursue their research question and what they are interested in. And for instance, one of my colleagues in Vienna has done a little empirical study on who are the people who work in startup and biotech companies. And it turns out these are mostly young people who are dissatisfied with the conditions they find at universities, and they are not very much attracted by working conditions in large corporations. So they settle into these biotech companies and they are quite satisfied there. Now, this may be an Austrian peculiarity, but nevertheless, it shows you individuals try to find their epistemic spaces and their niches and settle there. So despite all these large organizations, we have watch out for these epistemic spaces in which individuals thrive. But of course, on the large majority of especially individual researchers, we see the social shaping of their careers. They are under enormous pressure to publish. They are under enormous pressure where to do their postdoc. Very often it happens, and this is a bit worrisome, people choose the place where to do their postdoc on the criteria, where can I publish faster? So is it a research group that allows me to have a publication faster than I would if I went elsewhere? And this becomes the main criteria of shaping a career, and you can just feel this pressure. There's also what I call time's urgency and the politics of times for the careers of young scientists. There are normative signposts. What, you are already 30 and you have not already accomplished this and that. You're 35, then you are cut off from this kind of fellowship and that kind of, etc. So, you know, their career is under a tight temporal grid, and this is time's urgency. There's, of course, the question of precariousness, but also, and this is something that they have to decide, how entrepreneurial do I want to be, and how much do I want to fit into you know, the imagination of what a scientist. Craig Venter here, taken out by this nice book of Stephen Shapin, The Scientific Life, as the icon of combining both. But how many of the young people will be able to combine both, especially in the way how Craig Venter has been able to do it? Institutions are also under pressure, and despite all the talk about openness, we can clearly see the other side of the trend, namely the trend that comes from the new public management, key performance indicators, impact, whatever can be measured, is to be measured, and the pressure continues. Then there are the global societal challenges for which we are underprepared, all institutions and our universities are underprepared for it, and the possible role of funding industries. What about the state? Robert Gordon is an economic historian, an American economic historian, and he argues on the basis of data for the US that we are really in a time of economic stagnation. He says, forget all this hype about the singularity coming and we are at the brink of a new innovation wave. He says we are in a time of economic stagnation. And what he means, and this the data he provides, productivity growth has sharply declined in the US. It went down from 2.7 in the 60s to below 1%. There was a peak, an exception in the 1990s due to the digitalization reaching the economy. So this is one view of innovation and its, in his argument, overestimation of innovation. If you look at the book of by Mariana Mazzucato, she has been very forcefully arguing we tend to see only the market forces and we tend to eliminate from view, to hide from view, the strong role that what she calls the entrepreneurial state has played in the sense of funding basic research. Her examples, again, come mainly from the US, and she shows how all the successes that American corporations did have were possible only because federal money was poured into fundamental research. So the role of the state is something to consider, and states will not go away. So if we speak about the transformation of scientific work, the funding patterns, the long-term perspective, this is something to think about. What else? Let me just focus here very briefly on what I think is important, namely to rethink infrastructures. If we hear the word infrastructure, we tend to think in the 19th century way, you know, these are material structures, overground, underground, where electricity, water, whatever, sewage is being processed, matter is being processed. By now, infrastructures process all kinds of things, matter, but also they facilitate the movement of information, of ideas, of people. They are networks, they operate as a system. There's the technical function, but at the same time it goes beyond the technical function. So I think we need to begin to reconceptualize what are infrastructures and knowledge infrastructures all about. And obviously they are more than just large technical system. Now, what is also happening is that these data infrastructures do something that is very important and relevant. Namely, data must be curated, must be maintained for questions we do not know that will be posed in the future. So they must be made ready for repurposing, for selection, for being reused. And this means you need maintenance care, you need another ethos of curation. It's not enough to set something up and it will run by itself. You have to cure it, you have to be ready for questions you do not know as yet and to be able to reply to them. And of course, it also means we have to come up with new ethos of sharing, of ownership, of authorship, etc. Now, one idea of how this might go comes from Andrea Nannetti. He's a digital historian. And he has come up with this definition of a knowledge aggregator. And what he does, he uses traditional data, puts them on in a digital form, and he uses them as a tool, a mapping tool, to come up with new questions. So he's using and interrogating his traditional data, and he is asking questions about conflicts, about trade, etc. But it's in interaction with the digital world. And these are just some of the where I think this is a beautiful example of how you can understand a very familiar knowledge aggregator, a map. This is a map by Fra Maurer from Venice, dates back to the 15th century, and it's a knowledge aggregator because you can see what was necessary in terms of having information, data, knowledge, to put it together in this map that was available to the persons who did it. And there are other maps. This is going back to 1154. It's the first Arabic map. So you can also see the differences. The Chinese did the same. This is a Korean map. And this is a copy of a map that no one has found as yet, but the original presumably goes back to 1418 and shows that the Chinese discovered America. So these are kinds of knowledge aggregators. But the difference between a map and a digital mapping is, of course, a map, once you have done it, it's finished. You can use it, you can add to it, but you have to wait until you come up with a new map. And with a digital map, you can interact, you can change it in time, it allows you to react. And I think this is something we have to think about when we speak about the transformation of how science works, is this dynamics that is built into knowledge aggregators. Now, of course, you know, you have really to go into the depths. What is the knowledge that went into that? And of course, the purpose and the repurposing that that was done with it. Now, I want to finish by coming back to the theme of the radical openness of science. I hope I have shown to you that at the moment we face two trends, overall trends. One is the trend towards openness. And however vague it is, however much yet to emerge, comes with it, it's a movement. Citizen science has a past, it will not go away, it will change its form. Open innovation has a past, will not go away, will change its form, and also open access, data sharing, etc. The other trend is the opposite. It comes from looking at performance management, short-term impact, funders asking already before you start what will be the impact, give us the proof. The British have shown to us how to do it, and somehow, one way or other, we are going to follow. So these are two opposing trends. But my plea is really for openness of science in a much more radical sense. It's not just openness in terms of doing away with barriers and forging new links between scientific disciplines or institutions, universities, industry, ordinary citizens. It has to do with the fact that science is radically open towards the future. And science is the best humanity has invented, the best way of bringing the future into the present, a huge potential which needs to be actualized. And it has to be done in society and with society. There's the co-production, the co-evolution of science and society. But the radical openness of science has to do with uncertainty. The future is uncertain, and the research process itself is inherently uncertain. It thrives, science thrives at the cusp of uncertainty. It pushes us further into the territory of the unknown. And there are these rare moments of intense creativity, and Pierre Michel has written about it in a very lucid way, these rare moments of creativity when completely new perspectives are opened, of François Jacob, who has spoken about day science and night science, the frustration working in the lab, having to start again, the uncertainty that is there in night science before you emerge and you have something to present in day science. So this is part of this radical openness idea that I tried also to capture in my book, because the future, in my view, indeed, is open and it is uncertain. Thank you very much.